The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
And say hello to the person next to you. Be a little friendly. Wish each other a happy May Day. I always feel it's such a good thing to do, but then people just get started and they're so happy to connect. So take some of that joyful connectivity at the end of our program and chat some more with the people around you. Sound still okay for everyone? All right. So many of you here know that this past winter, 29 of us here at Common Ground committed to a 10-week training that was 4 hours of class time a week and a good 50 pages of reading every week. And it was anti-racism training. It was offered by the Anti-Racism Study and Discussion Circle Group. And it was a training that I believe started in some of the UCC churches and has been offered throughout Minnesota and is a national model. And it was one of the most wrenching experiences that I have had in years. In conventional terms, I am an extremely well-educated person. And in conventional terms, I am basically a good person, and I try to be really intentional about non-harming. And the Anti-Racism Study and Discussion Group made me acutely aware of how superficial my understanding of racism has been, and how my intentions and assumptions about my own goodness were really barriers to my understanding the complexity of racial oppression. And I am determined to continue to investigate my ignorance, my opinions, and my attitudes. And at the most fundamental level, the teachings of the Dharma really have been the tools that have been most helpful to me, and it's really what I want to share with you today. So I'm going to talk about Wise View and the White Racial Frame. The teachings of the Buddha's Eightfold Path to Liberation, which is also really the guide for wise living, can be grouped into three categories. The first category is the wisdom category, and under that we have wise view or wise intention. And the word sama, which is often the Pali word sama, is translated as wise. Sometimes people translate it as right, as in correct, or skillful. So people will talk about wise view, skillful view, right view. So the wisdom part is wise view or understanding, and wise intention is the second one. And then in the harmonious living part, there is wise action, wise speech, wise livelihood. And then the third part is mental cultivation, and that's wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. So what I'm going to be here this week and next week, and I'm going to talk about the wisdom part of the Eightfold Path, which is where we begin. But of course, the Eightfold Path isn't a linear path. It's much more eight aspects that continually intersect and reinforce one another. So it's not a linear progression at all. Wise view, sometimes translated skillful understanding, is really the Buddha's most fundamental teaching about the nature of reality. And it begins with the recognition of the conditionality of all of our experience. In other words, everything, all of our experience, is a matter of cause and effect. There is nothing that is uncaused, spontaneous, magical. That everything is a matter of causes and conditions. That's what brings the next moment into existence. So with everything we experience, we can always be looking at the causes of what brought it into being. And, you know, in our mindfulness practice, this is what we see all the time. You know, like you see your mind has taken off somewhere, and you observe that, and you see what came before that. What was the trigger? What was the cause? And mindfulness just brings us, as we pay more attention in our daily life to our own reactivity, we notice, okay, what brought that on? And it is just, this is so basic to the Buddha's understanding that it's everything is a matter of causes and conditions. And this is really what we're referring to when we talk about nature. You know, how often for people who come here regularly, Mark talks about, you know, it's just nature. It's nature over and over and over again. Nature in the Dharma is just the causes unfolding. Truly what we mean by nature generally. All organisms are subject to this conditionality. All organisms are subject to cause and effect. There's a wonderful now very elderly Sri Lankan monk who's lived in the U.S. for many, many, many years named Bhante Gunaratna, who teaches a lot about the Eightfold Path. And he says, realistic perception is the goal of mindfulness meditation, that we really see how things come into being and pass away. So the conditionality of experience is the basis of our understanding. And so then from that, the Buddha offers the teachings on what are the causes of suffering. So the first part of wise view is really getting everything is conditioned. Everything arises due to causes and conditions. And the second part of wise view is really coming to understand, okay, so what are the causes of suffering? And the word that is translated as suffering, the word dukkha, the Buddha says, you know, we all experience dukkha. The word dukkha etymologically comes from words that would suggest what happens when there is a misalignment between the hub of the wheel and the axle. So, you know, you get kind of this clunk, 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 the misalignment. So if we think of this word dukkha, that we all experience dukkha in our lives, suffering in our lives, we all experience some sort of misalignment with reality. Dukkha is also translated very often as dis-ease or dissatisfaction. It's one of those words that has no single easy English equivalent. In Pali, it had this more comprehensive understanding. So when we're talking about our suffering and the causes of suffering, we're talking about what is this misalignment. So the Buddha teaches that we all encounter this unsatisfactoriness, this misalignment. We react to our physical, mental, material circumstances with this sort of dissatisfaction. Even when things are going really well, there's a little part of us that says, this isn't going to last. I wish I could make it last. And how many of us have had the experience of going someplace really wonderful? You're in this beautiful place and you think, the next time I come back, I'm going to bring this person with me. I mean, we have a very hard time being content with our experience. And when we really bring reflection, when we really bring mindfulness to all of our experiences, we find that so often there's this little tinge of dissatisfaction. And the Buddha really wants us to examine that. So What is the cause of dukkha? What is the cause of this suffering? And the Buddha characterizes the cause of suffering. He uses the Pali word tanha, which literally means thirst. The cause of suffering is thirst. Well, what could that mean? Well, what is the experience of thirst? It's this experience of needing, of wanting, of feeling a little helpless. I mean, that when we're thirsty, there's often kind of an urgency to it, that we have this sense that we need to do something. And in English, tanha, in terms of the Buddha's teaching, is usually translated as craving or attachment, that the cause of our suffering is craving or attachment. And this is where this teaching really, for me, connected with the teachings about anti-racism. I started to think, what is it that I am really attached to? And often it's a fixed view of how my experience should be, or a fixed view about who or what I am. And the Buddha talks in many of the suttas, the Buddha talks over and over and over again about the dangers of fixed view, about the attachment to opinion, attachment to view. It's not that we can't have views and opinions. It's inevitable. But the Buddha said we really get into trouble when we really identify and attach to them. And this is where I really saw the connection with some of the anti-racism work. So one of the things that was a really painful, challenging aspect of this training was learning to recognize what a number of scholars have talked about as the white racial frame. And the scholar Joe Fagan is probably the person who has written most extensively on this. And I'm going to give you the academic definition of it and then talk about it. Fagan characterizes it as an overarching worldview encompassing important racial ideas and beliefs, terms, images, emotions, inclinations, and interpretations, and creating a way of being, perspectives on life, language and explanations that normalize and make sense of our society. So mostly, if you are white, the white racial frame is something that you are acting in and out of, and it's pretty invisible to you. For example, we would talk about Americans and then African Americans, Asian Americans. The white is the default, the norm, and it is so ingrained, and there are certain sorts of cultural values that are often understood as just sort of the normal values that we should have. What would be one? Efficiency. We should all be efficient, as opposed, say in the workplace, lots of nonprofits, you know, like efficiency, making do with the making the best use of time rather than really spending the time to connect with people. You know, like how many clients get served as opposed to, say, really connecting with clients, letting people feel that they can really be heard. And so often, you know, if you're in one of the helping professions, you know, you have to see so many people a day. Like, that's your job. Your job is to help them, and you can give everyone 20 minutes. And that's the way it's structured. And that's kind of normal because it's important to be efficient. It's important to see a lot of people. And, I mean, we just sort of take this as a norm. And there might be other ways of doing it. But this seems to be the right way. And that's the other part of it, that what seems normal is often what seems right. Or I recently listened to a book on CD called The Story of the Human Body, and it was a wonderfully fascinating book about the evolution of the human body. And the big takeaway from that was that we make this mistake of thinking what is comfortable is good, like sitting on chairs, wearing shoes, not having to chew really hard food. So things that we don't stress our bodies physically, stress our bones, stress our muscles in ways that would be more beneficial for us. So what is comfortable is not what is good, but we make that mistake all the time in our lives, over and over and over again. If we're in, and one of the things, you know, one of the great white frame fallbacks is, I'm just not comfortable with that, right? How many times we say, I'm just not comfortable with that, as if comfort is the criterion by which we should judge our experience, our relationships, our interpersonal reactions. And so often, for example, in the white racial frame, we would all talk about being colorblind. That's kind of a value in the white racial frame. So I don't see color. I treat all people the same way. Well, the data is, if you send a resume with Jamal Jackson or Tanisha Washington as opposed to John Smith or Susan Jones, that very same resume, with that being the only difference, gets a third to a half less responses. And we said we're colorblind. And you know, and then the interesting thing about this, and this is the real kicker, is that it doesn't have to be overt racism. What happens is, and this is again what social science teaches us, like social science, someone sent out all these resumes and saw what the response was. What we know is that we all tend to look for what is good in those who are like us. So, for example, if we all identify as Buddhists here, we would look, probably other Buddhists, we'd really, really notice the good qualities of other Buddhists. And we might notice some of the deficiencies of evangelical Christians. Okay? I mean, this is just the way we are. I mean, and there are evolutionary reasons for it. It's not that we're being bad. So if we have this sort of bias, this unconscious bias, right? If we get a resume and we see the name suggests this might be someone different than us, on an unconscious level, we will look for reasons why this person might not be the person we would choose. We are just much more inclined to look for the good qualities. And this happens also in issues of gender. You know, the same resume with a man's name and a woman's name on it. Many more responses to a man. And it's not that there's overt sexism, but you might see something on the resume and say, this is kind of curious. Huh. Well, or I know from having looked at a lot of resumes in my work life, you know, you see something and you say, well, this person did this. This person doesn't exactly have what I'm looking for, but this is kind of interesting. Let's look at this person. Whereas if it's someone who's clearly different, you might say, well, you know, this person just really doesn't have exactly what we're looking for. I mean, it can operate on that kind of a level. So looking at all these sorts of assumptions and biases, this idea of being colorblind, race always walks into the room. Whenever there is racial difference, race always walks into the room. And that was a really painful thing to really bring to the forefront of my consciousness. I remember years ago, A cultural critic named Pat Ofterheides said to me, Americans, meaning, of course, white Americans, spend so much time and energy not knowing that we actively have to put a lot of effort not to know how much suffering our own behavior causes people, like how we can have such cheap clothes, how we can have such cheap food, that we just think is kind of the norm because here in white America, we kind of do things right. And we have really cheap clothes and really cheap, compared to the rest of the world, really cheap clothes, really cheap food, and actually compared to a lot of parts of the world, really low taxes. So, we don't really make those comparisons and see that. So there's this idea of colorblindness as part of the idea of the white racial frame. The other part, which is really insidious, is individualism. And this really comes out of sort of the historical Enlightenment, the idea of human rights, individuals, real focus on individualism. And here in the United States, there is so much about individualism that, we talk about, for example, the Second Amendment, the right of individuals to have arms. And I didn't know until I took this course that the real impetus for the Second Amendment, for the militias and people being able to have guns, was actually the fear of slave revolts in the southern states. That we have that amendment because the slave owners wanted to be able to be armed. That makes the Second Amendment look a little different, but we completely frame that in terms of individual rights. And we completely frame racism in terms of individual people doing individual bad racist things, instead of seeing racism as something that is systemic, that's social, that is in many ways unconscious. We all take on, am I racist or am I not racist? And we have this idea, because all of us are here in a Buddhist community, which whether or not you identify yourself as Buddhist, you're here because you have an affinity for non-harming, for wanting to live an intentional life with integrity. So we have this concept of ourselves, and it's really painful to see how we may be participating in and benefiting from racist structures. I mean, another good example is after the Second World War, the GI Bill that enabled so many people here. They had grandfathers and family members who were able to be the first people in their family to go to college, to get an education. Only 4% of the GI Bill was able to be used by African Americans. And it was because of policies that colleges had quotas, that they did not allow many blacks in, that there were all sorts of barriers to people applying. So that the GI Bill, which for many working class Americans was their entree into the middle class, did not help them, did not help African Americans. The housing that came out after the Second World War, Levittown, all these housing, well, those housing developments all had racial covenants because the idea was that this would build equity for the owners. So there were racial covenants so that African Americans could not buy those houses because that would lower the value of the other houses. So African Americans had to buy, if they could buy, in places that were less desirable, and there was a formal ranking system. They often couldn't use the sort of banks and the financing, like Freddie Mae. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, couldn't use things like that because the places where they could buy were not approved. They weren't. They didn't meet the standards for federal lending. So a lot of us, we've said we had nothing to do with that, but we're benefiting from that. And African Americans are suffering from that. The legacy really goes on. So all of us who are white here, I would dare say, has benefited from this. So we really need to look at kind of the causes that brought us to where we are today, and to really make a wholehearted inquiry into our own racial conditioning. And I would encourage people to think about doing something that I have done, to my chagrin, and many other people have done, which is called the Implicit Association Test, IAT. And you can Google this and do this. And for example, what it will have you do, if you want to do one about racism, it will just ask you to, you'll get one column, it'll say white, black, white, black, white, black, black, and then it will have, say, either positive qualities or negative qualities. And it will ask you to, okay, so whenever white comes up and there's a positive quality next to it, click on that button. Okay, so you go down, 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 down. And then it can ask you to do that with blacks. Okay, blacks and positive qualities. We all can do this. We all can associate blacks with positive qualities. What we can't do it is in the amount of time it takes us to do whites. The implicit association test is a time test. And it shows us that it's just a little harder to associate virtue with blackness. And Malcolm Gladwell, the wonderful New Yorker writer who is Caribbean-Canadian, said it just stunned him that he too, I mean, here he is, a black man, he too had more negative associations. It took him longer. So this is something that is not just for white people who have absorbed these attitudes about the white racial frame, but it's also black people. I mean, this has been kind of, in the racism class, we talked about colonizing the mind and how often that happens. So so we really do need to, especially when we think of ourselves as good people with good intentions, realize how much of a threat to our identity it is to be able to open to recognizing how much we've benefited. And you know, and in this community where we are really, really trying to make an effort to really see our own stuff clearly, this is really important. And I also want to say that this is going on at Dharma centers all over the country. That in the words of one well-known Dharma center, they said, so we need to move from being essentially a club for white people to being an anti-racist organization. And a lot of times people said, I'm here to sit on a cushion. I'm not here to do anti-racism. You know, that's kind of what I do. I'm here to just kind of make peace with my own mind, to deal with my own suffering. And what we have to do is really make the effort to see how much of our suffering is really in protecting the kind of identities that we have. And that really is a source of stress, a source of disease, a source of misalignment, that trying to protect our own identities, protect our good opinion of ourselves as non-racist, well-intentioned people. There's a really good, very easy to read book called Waking Up White by Debbie Irving that talks about how in her family they talked about, you know, helping the poor Indians who just couldn't hold their liquor. And rather than saying, here's a traumatized people, and we actually paid them in alcohol for stuff historically. It's a really useful book, and I think there are things that many people in here would find that interesting. But coming to understand our own racial conditioning, the causes and conditions that contributed to who we are in this present moment, is really seeing things clearly, which is really what our practice is about. You know, and the Buddha tells us to abandon that which causes suffering, that which causes harm to ourselves and others. And it seems to me that dismantling the white racial frame is in alignment with this teaching. So I want to open this to questions and comments, but I first really would like to thank the people who have been most helpful to me in this, Dharma teachers, Mark Nunberg, Gina Sharp of New York Insight, Larry Yang of East Bay, Bonnie Duran, who's in Washington and who's going to be here this summer for the TCVC retreat, Terry Karras, who's come and has taught here, and also Okigamon, the person who developed the Aztec curriculum, the writers Claude Steele, Joe Fagan, Debbie Irving, Zenju Earthland Manual, and Ta-Nehisi Coates have all been writers, teachers who have really been generous, and I just feel so indebted to them and am so grateful to them. And I would love to have some discussion now, and then next week I'll be talking about the white racial frame and wise intention and how we can cultivate that. And we have a microphone here, and I'm going to turn it on, and we'll pass it around so that everybody can hear. No comments, questions in the back there.
Hi. I'm just curious as to action plans that were discussed, and because I attend UU Uptown as well, and the awareness is certainly one thing, but then how do we take it to the streets and really make a profound difference? Because we continue to hear, you know, the schools, the white, black, you know, it's just this constant, you're right, it's just, we've set up this framework. So, you know, the Second Amendment, just, it goes on and on and on. What sort of action plans could we develop to take out and make a profound difference?
Well, we certainly talked about that, and a number of our community members have been really active in Black Lives Matter and in providing support as allies. People have supported with donations. There's also the idea that you make this intention that every chance you get, you speak truly about what you see going on in a way that is truthful and, if you can, helpful. I mean, we talk about recognition, resistance. People talked about, you know, someone says, well, I volunteer at, you know, a home for older people, and these gentlemen just kind of go on and on with their political views, and they're really obnoxious, but what do I do? And you say, you know, that's interesting. That's just not been my experience. Which is just a wonderful, you don't have to say, I don't believe what you're saying, I disagree. You know, what we can do, we so often think that we need to kind of get the big action plan. And the big action plan may appear at some point. But while we're waiting to be clearer about that, what we should do is take all the baby steps that we can and just say something. When someone says something, you say, you know, that's not my experience. Why do you think that's the case? Or we did a lot of training with something that's called sleight of mouth, which is sort of like sleight of hand. It's about turning the tables in discussion. And there are books and tapes about that to really learn, because often we mean to do the right thing, and we just don't have the script, you know, like you're home and half an hour. I said, oh, I should have said that. So you practice that. You develop some scripts. And to really just as, you know, with as much integrity as you can, really call things out and acknowledge, you know, your my own collusion in this. Does that make sense? Other comments? Back there.
Hi, this is Dan. You really enlightened me a little bit here on an aspect. It just kind of dawned on me that when I listen to the broader messy discourse of our politics, that a lot of the words, a lot of things that are said counter to, let's say, the viewpoint that you're espousing is the words are used more as a foil as opposed to an expression of belief. So in other words, it's a defense towards some embedded feeling as opposed to espousing kind of the logical progression. I don't know if I'm carrying this out very well, but it seems like in the greater practice in our culture, we use words as a foil. I don't have any great enlightenment beyond that, other than the fact that knowing that when I hear, say, like a Rush Limbaugh, to pick on an obvious person, both in the tone and the words that he uses, is learned to be artful in provoking things. But that provoking isn't necessarily a discussion, a sincere discussion of a position, as it is a defense of the worldview. And at least in hearing you talk about it, in seeing it as a defense, it kind of changes my posture. It makes me less likely to try to engage on the word format and more likely to say, just as you were saying, this is not about words. It's about how you see the world and how you're going to engage with it. Hopefully I explained that reasonably well. It's kind of embedded in there, but I just think so much of it is what goes on is behind a curtain. I think it happens on both sides of the spectrum too. So I don't think any particular political spectrum is immune to it. So,
in nonviolent communication, when you study and work with that, it's all about really trying to understand the emotions and the needs underneath what's being said. And so, is this person fearful and needing reassurance? And, you know, a lot of rhetoric that we hear that may be extremely distasteful and hostile is about people fearing. I mean, it goes back a lot to the idea of identity threat and feeling that their identity, their position, their beliefs are under attack and not knowing what would be there if they were taken away. So, I mean, it's not to demonize anyone in this. I mean, the Buddha said, you know, we all suffer. That's our experience. So we really try to understand the suffering of another. We also really need to act as best we can to prevent others from harming themselves or others. But we recognize that everyone is suffering.
So it's really enlightening, really. So a conversation is more about loving kindness, enlightening, engaging, instead of confronting, of course.
Well, the Buddha talks about how the states of the blessed states of mind are loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity. And the idea that, you know, can we always have our minds in one of those places? Could it be compassion when we hear someone just on a tear, on a rant, someone feeling completely that he's being disenfranchised? Can we really bring some compassion to that person's fear, that person's sense of how things are being diminished. So, you know, and equanimity, which is just kind of staying steady. And we see the children are here. So thank you all so much for your wonderful participation. And I hope we'll continue this next week. And we welcome the children to come and lead us in a joyful song.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.